Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking about Vietnam, a country that certainly has come a long way since the end of the conflict that people there call the American War. Vietnam now has Asia's second fastest growing economy, outpaced only by China. It has attracted investors from around Asia and from the outside. And in fact, the country's one-time enemy, the United States, is now Vietnam's main trading partner. Just recently, the country hosted a meeting of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum. President Bush was in attendance, and in fact, this was the first state ever of a U.S. president to Vietnam. Just this week, Vietnam's legislature ratified the country's entry into the World Trade Organization. We thought it would be a good time to talk a little bit about Vietnam and how it has changed, particularly in recent decades. And to do that, we have joining us this morning Christoph Giebel. He is Associate Professor of International Studies and History at the University of Washington in Seattle. He grew up in Germany and was educated there. He also was educated here in the United States. He has his PhD in Southeast Asian history from Cornell. He also studied Chinese and Vietnamese studies in Germany and Taiwan and Vietnam. He's been interested in Vietnam for quite a long time, going back to 1980, when he spent a year working in medical services for Vietnamese refugees in Indonesia. In 1986, he became the first West German, and in fact, one of the first Western students overall to be allowed to enroll in a Vietnamese university. And he spent a year at the National University of Hanoi. He's returned to Vietnam many times over the last 15 years, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here in the conversation, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. All you have to do, just pick up the telephone and dial the number again, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Giebel, hello.
Yes, hello, good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
I appreciate it. I'm sure that everywhere you go in Vietnam, or many places that you go in Vietnam, there are reminders of the war. At the same time, my understanding is something like 70% of the population of Vietnam was born since 1975, and so they don't remember the war at all. What is the significance today, particularly for young Vietnamese, of the what we call the Vietnamese War, what they call the American War?
Well, just like anywhere else, wars, of course, linger for a long time in a nation's memory. And so, even though so many people have no personal experience of the war, of course, they are aware of the war through family tales and experiences of their parents and grandparents. But you're quite right. In daily life, the war for most of Vietnamese plays a very minor role, if it surfaces at all, in their daily lives. On the other hand, you're quite right. You travel through Vietnam, you pass reminders of the war all the time, and the government certainly also keeps the memory of the war alive for its purposes of legitimizing its existence.
Talk about that a little bit more. Does the government use this as a rallying point to justify whatever its policies are, but also to say that somehow the people need to hang together?
Yes, the Vietnamese government and the Communist Party see themselves as the protector of the nation, and they were the ones to step up to fight for independence and unity against foreign aggressors in their parlance. So it's very clear that the war plays a central role in how the Communist Party legitimizes itself towards the population.
It seems to me to be remarkable, given the history involving the two countries, Vietnam and the United States, that at this point the relationship should be as positive as it is. But it is. How do people in Vietnam today think about the United States?
I think there's a very, very positive feeling towards America. Many American visitors to Vietnam have commented about that, that they found the country to be extremely friendly and open to them. People usually don't want to talk about the war very much, and they certainly also are very quick to say that there's a difference between government and military policies in the past and the average people. So it's, as I said, for many American visitors, it's a very welcoming country, beautiful country too. And,
We talked to, I just mentioned the fact that, in, particularly in recent years, the economy of Vietnam has been doing very well, and that in Asia, next to China, it's the second fastest growing.
Right. Yeah.
And I know that you're not an economist, but I'm sure that you have seen this happen. How does one account for the rapid growth in the economy, particularly I suppose since economic reforms were introduced back in the would have been in the mid 1980s.
Yeah, by 1986, the first reforms were introduced, but they didn't really produce tangible results until the late 80s at the earliest. So by around 1990, you can see the first improvements in the economic performance and in the living standards. But it has really accelerated over the course of the 1990s. And now in the first years of this millennium, the economy has been booming. The economic crisis in 1997 has hit Vietnam to a much lesser degree than other countries in Asia. And so since 1998, it's just been a really good run for the Vietnamese economy. I think building on the foundation of the reforms that were started in the 1980s.
To what extent is Vietnam still an agrarian country and an agrarian economy? And how much movement has there been perhaps away from that, something that is primarily based on agriculture, to something where manufacturing has a greater role?
Well, in its majority, the Vietnamese people still are farmers, but that number is shrinking. So when you talk about an agrarian society in pre-colonial, colonial times, you would see the numbers like 90% of the people would be engaged in agriculture. But that number is rapidly declining now. I mean, I can't tell you exactly how many people now are engaged in agriculture, but I would still think it's more than half. But the economic performance of Vietnam has, of course, resulted in improved living standards, especially in the cities. And so there is a kind of magnetic force going from the countryside to the cities. A lot of people are now migrating into the cities in hope of finding better paying work. But the agricultural sector will remain for a very long time the mainstay or the backbone of the Vietnamese economy. And a lot of the export products of Vietnam nowadays are still agriculturally based, either through food products or even seafood.
I'm sure that the kind of changes that we're talking about do result in dislocations within society. Certainly, we've seen in other kinds of places where you see the shift of a focus perhaps from acknowledging the fact that agriculture still is going to be important, sort of a shift in the focus towards from rural to urban, from agriculture to manufacturing. That, I'm sure, must be difficult. Particularly for people who do live in rural areas. Have rural people managed to enjoy some of the benefits of the improvements in the economy that we have talked about?
Yes. I would think that the benefits of this economic performance has been pretty widespread. But undoubtedly, wealth distribution is now much more happening in the cities. But one should not forget that the economic reforms in the mid and late 1980s actually started in agriculture. There was a food crisis in the mid 1980s. The country had really hit rock bottom, and it was particularly the freeing of market forces in the countryside that helped Vietnam come out of these food crises. So overall, in the rural areas, reforms have been benefiting quite a bit. But now, in the last decade or so, the focus has much more been on the urban sector.
Mm-hmm. Our guest is part of Focus 580 is Christoph Giebel. He is Associate Professor of International Studies and History at the University of Washington in Seattle. And we're talking about Vietnam today. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's the number for Champaign Urbana listeners. And we do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. And that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 for people here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, a toll-free 800-222-9455. Vietnam was a country that, at least at the time that the war was going on, was a country that was divided north from south, divided politically, and one that was reunified by force of arms. Is there still in the sense a sense among people in Vietnam of regional identity? Are there still north-south divisions, and are there people, depending on where they come from, do they really think of themselves as northerners or southerners, and is that significant?
Very complicated question, very complicated answer, but let me try to tackle this one. Regional differences have existed in Vietnam for probably several hundred years. But with the rise of nationalism in response to the colonial occupation by France, these were oftentimes covered over, since the rallying cry for the anti-colonial movement was to get rid of foreign occupation and reassert an independence of a whole nation. So the idea of a united nation, of a united country, was very prominent in nationalist discourses. So regionalism, again, has always been a factor. During the war years, regionalism was, at least in revolutionary propaganda, was downplayed a lot. And it really only came much more to the fore again after 75 with the rather heavy-handed imposition of Hanoi rule in the south. And what is, I think, little understood in America is that the great disaffection of people in the south not only was among those who were associated with the Saigon government, but the disaffection also happened among those people in the South who were very actively supporting the revolution. They felt after 75 that all their sacrifices and their contributions to the victory in 1975 was kind of brushed aside by Hanoi in what some observers would say is the triumphalism of the Communist Party based in Hanoi after 1975.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, Vietnam was actually never divided. That is kind of a misunderstanding that is very prevalent. Vietnam, for many people in Vietnam, there was never a division. In fact, what a lot of Vietnamese thought was happening was a denial after the French War of letting Vietnam go free and independent under the rule of Ho Chi Minh. So there was never an understanding among Vietnamese that here was one country that is called North Vietnam and one country that is called South Vietnam.
Yeah, I think part of the reason of asking is having read about some of what's gone on, particularly this year in politics, and the fact that earlier in the year, the National Assembly of Vietnam approved the two new leaders, a new prime minister and new president. Both of them, and it's my, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, both that my understanding is both these men are Southerners.
Yes, deep roots in the South.
And that's significant, and maybe something of a departure from a policy in the past where the party had, in choosing people who were going to be leadership, somehow felt that it was important to have some sort of balance of regional identity. So you wanted to have some people from the North, some people from the central part of Vietnam, some people from the South, and that to have the two people who are Southerners in these very important positions seemed like a significant departure from that that earlier idea that somehow everything has to be balanced.
Yes. No, I mean, the revolutionary movement always tried to balance out in the leadership Northerners and Southerners, but that oftentimes was more of a tokenism for Southerners than anything else. You know, the first decade after 75, as I said, you know, you can probably headline under triumphalism. But then by the mid-1980s, it becomes very clear for the leadership that they have to radically change course. That, I mean, this is a shipwreck about to happen. And so there are very concerted efforts to make amends and to bring in the South more prominently. And so since the 1990s, leadership positions have been given to Southerners in increasing numbers, and I think that both the president and the prime minister are now Southerners speaks volumes.
Mm-hmm. How much control over daily life in Vietnam does the Communist Party have?
The state has been in retreat from society for now the last 15 years. Part of the reforms was that the state acknowledged in many ways that it could not regulate everything. It could not have a command economy. And so economic reforms were also accompanied with a retreat of the state from the kind of daily life. So education is not much freer now. There are private universities. The kind of daily controls in the life of people through, neighborhood committees or so is much less than it used to be. Social services have also declined as a result and have to be picked up by kind of an emerging civil society in Vietnam. So in many ways, it is a radically different country than say, from the 1980s.
Yeah. Is there any sort of organized, any sort of political opposition, organized or otherwise, to the party?
Well, that is the one area where the party is holding firm. In fact, throughout the 1980s, it kind of allowed two kind of token other parties to exist, and then by the early 1990s, the party, in fact, enshrined its leadership role in the Constitution, and it does not allow any other political parties to exist. So political leadership is, through constitutional means, is now enshrined to be the Communist Party. The word political pluralism is, in many ways, is banned in Vietnam. That is the one area, political control, political leadership, where the party is unwilling to give any grounds.
Mm-hmm. Is that something that there's a great deal of demand for, political pluralism, the opportunity to engage in dissent? Or does it seem to be the case, as perhaps some other places, that where people are primarily concentrating on are maybe more economic issues?
Well, the answer is both. In both cases, is yes. I mean, of course, people would like to have, the right and the opportunity to speak their minds and to form alternative association in the political arena. I think this is pretty universal. On the other hand, Vietnamese today see where they can thrive, in which areas they can thrive, in which areas it would be dangerous to engage. And so I think a lot of Vietnamese are simply focusing on their economic well-being and to adjusting to this very new world in which they are living, in which Vietnam becomes more and more integrated into world economy, rather than expending their energies on a rather fruitless seeming endeavor to demand greater political freedoms. On the other hand, there are some prominent dissidents that are trying to organize politically in Vietnam, both north and south. Some of them, in fact, having been politically active even before 1975 in protest of the Saigon government. So, yes, there is some dissent, some dissidence, but for most Vietnamese, I think they are focusing on their private lives, on the betterment of their education and economic standing.
Mm-hmm. I want to perhaps give you the opportunity to talk a little bit more about the Doi Moi reforms of 1986, mm-hmm. just because if you look at what's happened here in the last couple of decades, this was a watershed moment, these changes, and perhaps yeah. made the economic growth that we have talked about possible. What was happening at that point that made it possible for these kind of reforms to be instituted in the first place? And why then did it happen at that moment?
By the early mid-1980s, the economic situation in Vietnam was completely dire. It was on the verge of collapse. Command economy would not work. The attempt to integrate the southern economy, the capitalist southern economy, into the northern command economy had failed. It was in 1978, the government had banned private enterprises even in the south, which made basically the southern economy collapse from one day to another. Food shortages were were on the horizon. So there was a lot of popular pressure from below to the leadership to change course. And that is often something that is overlooked when people from outside look at Vietnam and what triggered the reforms. On the other hand, what also was a big factor was the opening of the Soviet Union under Gorbachev in 1985. And the Gorbachev reforms had two tracks. One was glasnost, openness, the political opening of the Soviet Union, of the party to be more willing to talk about its mistakes, to listen to alternative voices. The other one, of course, is perestroika, the renovation, economic renovation policies. And that was something that for the Vietnamese leadership that was very dependent on the Soviet Union provided a kind of a roadmap to reform. So it was both pressure from below. In fact, there were peasant riots in some localities demanding greater freedom to produce for markets, as well as the influences from the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. There seem to be parallels between what the Vietnamese did and what has happened in China.
Mm-hmm, certainly.
And which makes me want to maybe have you talk a little bit about the relationship between Vietnam and China, which, you know, we talk about perhaps tension between the U.S. and Vietnam, given the war, given the fact that the Chinese and the Vietnamese have been fighting for a whole lot longer than did the Americans and the Vietnamese. You know, you'd think that there might be some cause for tension between those two countries, and certainly North Vietnam borders on the southern part of China. What is the state of the relation these days between the governments of Vietnam and China?
Relations are pretty good, in part because both China and Vietnam have made very similar conclusions, have drawn very similar conclusions from the Eastern European revolutions of 89. Both Vietnam and China at that point were engaged on a course of economic reforms and political opening, cautious as it was. But in any case, they had allowed more public debates. And then, of course, in China, you have the Tiananmen crisis and the massacre to end it. And then the very rapid dissolution of the Eastern Bloc. The conclusion that both the Chinese and the Vietnamese leadership were drawing was to clamp down on the political opening. And so by 1990, it's very clear that in both countries, the Communist Party reasserts itself, but then accelerates the speed of economic liberalization to compensate for the political clampdown. And that ironically brought the two countries close together again after almost two decades of very frosty relationships in the 1970s and 80s that, of course, culminated in the border war of 1979.
We are just a bit past our midpoint here, and perhaps I should introduce again, for the benefit of anybody who has just recently tuned in, introduce again our guest, Christoph Giebel. He is Associate Professor of International Studies and History at the University of Washington in Seattle. He's trained in Chinese and Vietnamese studies in Germany, Taiwan, and Vietnam. He has a PhD in Southeast Asian history from Cornell. He has been interested in Vietnam for a long time. In 1996, he became the first West German and one of the first Western students overall to be allowed to enroll in a Vietnamese university. And he spent a year at the National University of Hanoi. He's been back to Vietnam many times over the last 15 years. His particular interest, academic interest, is the contemporary Vietnamese history, 20th century Vietnamese history. And questions are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. I did mention earlier that we have talked some about economics, and I know that you're not an economist particularly, but that you certainly have followed the kind of economic development that's happened in the country. I mentioned a couple of days ago that the legislature, the Vietnamese legislature, ratified the country's entry into the World Trade Organization. How significant is this for Vietnam?
I think it's very significant, and in many ways, but one of them, of course, symbolically. Vietnamese have tried for a decade now to get admission to membership into the WTO. Vietnam is, after the very crippling economic embargo of from 1975 into the 1990s, has been trying very hard to find acceptance in the international arena. And they have lamented for a long time that they felt snubbed and misunderstood. So I think there's a great symbolic victory, so to say, for Vietnam. And I think that translates also in the kind of popular perception. For Vietnamese, it is very important to feel that they are seen as an industrious and peaceful country, and not always associated with the past wars.
One of the things that I wanted to talk about was talked a little bit earlier about the fact that certainly, while on the one hand people don't think about the war all the time, and that there are a lot of young Vietnamese that were born since the war, so for them that this was not a part of their real life experience. At the same time, you can see the legacy of the war. There are reminders of the war. And one of apparently the persistent leftovers from the war are serious environmental issues. One in its particularly serious in various places in the country. One of those things has to do with contamination from Agent Orange. I'm sure that there are also issues with unexploded ordnance. Are there significant, or perhaps I should just say, what are the significant environmental issues that are indeed leftovers from the war?
Well, I think you put your fingers on the two major ones. In some parts of Vietnam, especially near the former demilitarized zone of the 17th parallel in the highlands, but in many parts of what used to be southern Vietnam, Environmental contamination is a huge problem, and leftover ammunitions and mines and unexploded bombs still kill Vietnamese today. That also is, of course, a problem in the north, where American bombing, of course, took place as well. These will be legacies of the war that will stay with the Vietnamese probably for generations. And Vietnam has tried in many ways to find some relief from the United States. There are some attempts now to bring Agent Orange litigation in American courts, so far unsuccessful. But I believe that we will not have seen the last of these attempts to find some recourse. Having said that, there are quite a number of kind of American citizen-to-citizen initiatives to heal the wounds of war, to work with mine victims, to address the issue of Agent Orange. And I'm working with one of these organizations, Peace Trees, out here in the Seattle area, that has been working for a while now in just below the DMZ, the demilitarized zone, in mine awareness programs, in reforestation, and so on.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly something that clearly, even though we've talked about the fact that Vietnam and the Vietnamese economy is doing well, this is certainly something that the Vietnamese, it's going to be a very expensive problem to deal with, and the Vietnamese are going to need help with. And it would seem to be a natural thing that the United States would want to help. And here we're talking about the kinds of cleanups, though, that I would imagine would cost certainly millions of dollars, if not tens of millions of dollars, to try to deal with.
Yes, when we talk about the symbolism of WTO membership, there's also a lot of symbolism in America. I think the United States government is reluctant to formally acknowledge formally acknowledge that it has a part in these problems, because it would open wounds again. It would, of course, open the door to litigation and all of these things. The question of reparation has been a very sensitive one in the United States since 1975. And generally, I think it's much harder oftentimes for Americans to talk about the war legacies, and it is, in fact, for the Vietnamese.
Well, we have a caller to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? Someone in Morris. This is our line number one. Hello.
Hi. I guess my question would be, and maybe someone to comment, I was in Vietnam in 1968 in the Central Highlands, and it's 2 years from now, it'll be 40 years, and I have a dichotomy there, I guess, when one side of me says, you forgive, you forget, you go on, and I understand that. The other side of me, it bothers me a little bit that our president goes there. He's on this campaign to the Middle East to bring democratic governments to help them, to hinder anybody that's not, but he goes to a communist state and talks about a great future. And I see the Communist Party, when they killed a lot of the mountain yards, mountain people, after the war, what they had done to the economy of South Vietnam, the persecution that goes on today of Christians in Vietnam. And I wonder, how do you balance those two, and what's the right decision?
Well, Professor Giebel, can you reflect on that?
I think we have to be pragmatic in many ways, and just like the Vietnamese are moving on and cannot linger on the war, this is in international diplomacy what has to happen. We have to find ways to coexist, to cooperate, and move on. It's, as I said, Vietnam, compared to, let's say, 20 years ago, is a completely different country. Yes, it's ruled by a communist party, but it's communist really in name only. It's a thriving capitalist economy. Political and religious freedoms have been rising, not to the extent that many of us would like it to rise, but it has been relaxing. The party has been relaxing its grip on the society. So I will I would understand why the United States leadership would like to move ahead in a more cooperative spirit.
Caller, do you want to follow up or make any other comment?
Well, I guess that I know some people that were in an orphanage there, a Christian orphanage, and they said the persecution of Christian people in Vietnam has gotten worse in the last 10 years, not better. And I say it bothers me when our president goes there and talks in glowing terms about it. And I guess I'm willing to forgive and forget, but I don't want to be the largest trading partner with Vietnam. It seems like we're going hand in hand helping the communist regime say, you know what, communism actually does work.
Well, I think the persecution of Christians or religious persecution is something that does take place in Vietnam, but it takes place in very different ways according to region. So it's interesting that you singled out the highlands, because in the highlands in the last decade, 12, 15 years or so, evangelical Christianity has made significant inroads, especially among ethnic minorities. And there, indeed, you find that the Vietnamese authorities are very nervous about the potential for social and political disruption in the wake of Christianization there. So, yes, in the highlands especially, religious persecution is a fact. On the other hand, a veritable religious revival has been taking place over the last 15 years in Vietnam, and most of the Christian practitioners will find that they have pretty much complete freedom of worship. So it depends very much on locality, on the kind of the political, the messy kind of political history of the localities involved.
Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. We have just about 10 minutes or so in this part of Focus 580. Again, I'd like to introduce the guest, Christoph Giebel. He is Associate Professor of International Studies and History at University of Washington, Seattle. His field of study is 20th century Vietnamese history. He's been there a number of times over the past 15 years and has been interested in and studying Vietnam going back to 1980. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We mentioned, the caller mentioned the fact that just about 10 days ago or so, the president was there. President Bush was in Vietnam for this meeting of the APEC Forum, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum. I think his hope in before he went was that the Congress was going to pass a bill that would have lifted some restrictions on trade with Vietnam that had been in place for a long time. And that the Congress decided not to do that, and particularly I think that this was Republicans in the Congress. So Mr. Bush was not able to go there to Vietnam with that in hand. It may come back around with control of the Congress changing, you know, who knows what might happen next time around. But I think in looking at this, some people ask the question, well, what is this really about? Did this say something about American concerns purely about trade? That is, was this just a trade issue and they were interested in the trade balance between the two countries and perhaps protecting particularly the American textile industry? Or was there still some lingering bad feeling among some people in the Congress about Vietnam? And did this indeed have something to say about people's feelings about relations between Vietnam and the United States? Which of those things do you think that it was, or was it some of both of those things?
It's some of both, but I would think that kind of lingering misgivings about Vietnam is probably the smaller factor of the two. Vietnam is now with membership in the WTO now is fully in the currents of corporate-driven globalization, and as in many other countries of the developing world, the globalization means oftentimes having to compete with very long-standing and entrenched economic interests in the industrialized nations. And so I think the reluctance of Congress to give a most favored nation a trading status with Vietnam has to do with these with the sense that garment industry in the United States, or as we had for a few years ago, the catfish industry in the United States, has to be protected from the new competition coming out of Vietnam and other countries. Mm-hmm. So I think it is more the kind of nervousness, the jitters about the new trade regime that might have produced the outcome that we see now.
Let's talk with someone else. This is a caller in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Yeah, on the lighter side, I wanted to talk a little bit about the food. When I taught school in Chicago, I had a student from Vietnam, and I mentioned to her that I like spicy food. I had a lot of experience with Thai food. But she brought in a couple sandwiches, and I bit into them, and I thought I was close to death with the high spices. And then I took off some of the spices and bit into the sandwich again and discovered that the spices are also in the bread. So I don't know, just maybe a brief little experience about your food, you know, experience with food there.
Well, I love Vietnamese food. I've always loved it. There are actually a great variety in regional tastes. It's not only spicy. Vietnamese food is puts a high premium on freshness, on herbal tastes that mingle with spiciness. So it's a variety of things, and maybe you were just unlucky to find a particularly spicy dish that didn't go well with you.
Well, I mean, I'm not being critical. It's just that I was just sort of taken back. In fact, I was sort of breathless, you know. But I do like the blend of spices with Thai food.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly would probably love, you know, food from there if I knew how to select. I understand too. Is there a big organic food, or a lot of strength in terms of organic farming there, or not? Or is this just something?
Oh, unfortunately, I can't answer that question. I don't know anything about organic farming in Vietnam. But again, I think Vietnamese cuisine is very much based on the idea of freshness, of using herbs and spices to produce the wonderful results.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Do you think that perhaps if the relationship between Vietnam and the United States continues to grow, there are more kinds of contacts and ties, that there indeed we will see in the United States more, we'll have the opportunity to be more exposed to Vietnamese culture?
Well, by all means. And America is getting exposed to Vietnamese culture, of course, in many ways all the time. I mean, there are more than a million Vietnamese Americans living in this country, and they have certainly benefited American culture in many ways through their cultural influences. But we're now living in an increasingly interconnected world, and even if we don't want to, we will have a lot of influences from abroad now coming in. Vietnam, I think the Vietnamese people are very open to these contacts. As I said in the beginning, it's a very friendly country, and in many ways it's an irony of history that for American travelers in Southeast Asia, Vietnam is probably the safest country to travel.
Hmm. And certainly the culture of Vietnam has been influenced by other cultures, particularly China. Are there ways in which today, when you travel around Vietnam, And I'm certain because of the colonial experience, there are French influences. Are there ways that when you travel around Vietnam today, would you see things that you know are the result of the fact that America had been involved in the country?
Yes. I think, as I said, Vietnamese are very thinking very positively about America and American pop culture, American consumer culture. Now is very prevalent in especially in the big cities of Vietnam. You walk also through the cities of Vietnam and find some remnants of French colonial architecture. There are old people who still love to talk about French literature that has been an important influence in their early lives. On the other hand, Vietnamese will always say that they cherish their independence. So they are welcoming of foreign influences as long as these foreign influences do not try to impose political control over them. And this makes for this very interesting cultural and political mix in Vietnam. It has for centuries been open, especially in the southern half of Vietnam, open to foreign influences. It has integrated these foreign influences rather smoothly, but it has taken up arms whenever foreigners have tried to impose their will on them.
Hmm. Let's take another call in Urbana, line 2.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. It is so interesting, and I appreciate all your observations. I was in Vietnam in March on a tourist trip. It was a wonderful trip. It was exciting. People were friendly. I felt safe except for the traffic because of those motor scooters and motorcycles.
Yes.
I mean, it's just an astonishing thing with three or four or five people on one motor scooter and children in between and babes in arms. It was just incredibly balanced and the way they made room for pedestrians. I thought people were I was amazed at the luxury hotels and the restaurants, which are wonderful. And I wanted to mention that we have a very, very good Vietnamese-owned market here on Fifth Street, just below University Avenue. It's called the Far East. And on Tuesdays and Fridays, they bring in all kinds of wonderful vegetables and authentic foods, and every Japanese and Chinese and all the Asians come there, and I go there probably every week or every second week because I cook a lot of that food. We went to a couple of French restaurants, which were great, and the festivals, we felt part of them. There was a moon festival, and people were on the river with the lanterns, and we felt that people were educated and busy and seemed happy in a community. We were told that the medical care is not very good for ordinary people, and I'd like you to, if you can answer it in a couple of words, that only government workers and the military are covered. I don't know what else, but it was not the best. And I don't know if there were limitations on having children. Those kinds of things were never clear. I thought going into temples and pagodas, and in fact one place where it was multi-religious, where it was Confucianism and Muslim and Christian and the Buddhism. It was just sort of an amazing place. The architecture, I'm an art historian, and I thought the architecture was terrific. I found it varied and so interesting. We went into all kinds of, you know, a rubber plantation, all kinds of wonderful things. Mm-hmm. So maybe you can mention this thing about education and medical care and children.
Okay. Well, Professor Giebel, can you do that?
Well, certainly here's a caller who fell in love with Vietnam, and I can fully understand that. Two children is supposed to be the norm or the maximum for Vietnamese couples. The government puts a lot of resources and energies in public campaigns of reminding people not to have more than two children. It's nothing compared to the sometimes draconian measures that the Chinese government is taking. But clearly, for Vietnamese and for the Vietnamese government, it's clear that that to go on in the kind of economic boom requires that people are responsible in their family planning. Medical care, yes, Vietnam is still a very poor country in comparison. It has a proud history of medical accomplishments prior to 75 and after 75, but overall, of course, it is nothing compared to Western standards of medical care. Access to medical care is oftentimes depending on what is in your wallet, and that is a very unfortunate reality. The government has, in the last years, started a healthcare system with access, privileged access by government workers, and we'll have to see how this will work out. But for the time being, it's oftentimes that you have to pay out of pocket or rely on the larger family to help you out in a health situation.
Well, there, I think we're going to have to stop because we've come here to the end of the time. Our guest, Christoph Giebel, is Associate Professor of International Studies and History at University of Washington in Seattle. And Professor Giebel, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure.